Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and we would like to welcome our three fabulous guests that are going to be on today's show. We're going to kick it off with the writing team of Gary Williams and Vicki Nerley. Then we're going to have our Barry Flowers. And then calling us all the way from France is going to be Sylvia Grantier. Now, I'm sure I screwed that name up, and hopefully she will fix it when she is on. So we got 90 minutes here of Suspense Radio coming straight to you, and it all begins right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
Again, I would like to welcome everybody to this great Saturday, September the 8th here on Suspense Radio. You might want to excuse me if I'm just a little bit quieter than normal. I've switched to from Diet Coke to the Soda Stream, and it's just taking me a little bit to just kind of, you know, get myself into it. But besides that, I would like to welcome here our first guest on the show. It's the writing team of Gary Williams and Vicki Nerley. Their book is called Indisputable Proof. Gary and Vicki, we would like to thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Doing fantastic, John. Thanks a lot. And on behalf of Vicki and myself, we really appreciate you having us on. We love this show.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
Yes, and we would like to thank you guys so much for coming on. We want to let everybody know that your website is williamsnerley.com. If I mispronounce that, please let me know because I suck.
That's absolutely perfect, and most people do screw it up, so I'm impressed.
but that's spelled KNERLY.com, so that's WilliamsNerley.com to find out information if you're listening to the show right now or when you do listen to it, you can, you know, sit there and check it out. So the book's an Indisputable Proof, and what you've kind of done here is, you know, you're using very much historical fiction and very in-depth detail. Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you explain exactly what Indisputable Proof is in your own words to kind of let the listeners know?
Sure. I'll take it first, Vic. And
sure.
Basically, Indisputable Proof is our first global thriller. We have written two previous novels that were really more centric to Northeast Florida and Southeast Georgia, where Vicki and I live. But this really is a global thriller that involves a CIA agent who is brought in to hunt for a religious artifact that's been stolen from a church in Spain. And what we like to do, Vicki and I are both history buffs to a great degree, so we like to take things that are historical mysteries or things that were really historical details that you may not know about, but most people, once you expose it to them, find them very fascinating. So we tried to integrate a lot of that into the storyline. And again, it involves this agent who ends up getting involved with this search for this artifact, and after there are some murders that occur in the form of Jesus's apostles, the way they were executed. So it's a very complicated, very suspense type deal, and Vicki and I had to do a lot of research on this book, not only the places and the people, but a lot of the historical facts. Especially when you're dealing with anything that's tied to the Bible, such as this is, you want to make sure what you've got is as historically accurate as possible. And we try to do that as much as we can. Vic, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Just when you're reading the novel, plan on going to exotic places like Costa Rica, Egypt, Greece, Sweden, literally all over the world.
Now, and the book kind of focuses around, I guess, the shroud of Jesus, where you know, where you mentioned here in the book that it's the theft of it from a cathedral that was in Spain, and that's what kind of sparks everything on. Did you decide that that's how you wanted to kind of write about that particular event with the shroud, being able, you know, and then kind of just working it from there?
Yeah, we did, John. I think, and just to so people aren't confused, it's not the Shroud of Turin, which is kind of a very well-known artifact. This is called the Sidarium of Evita, and it's purportedly a linen that was placed across the face of Jesus Christ while he was still on the cross at the time of his death. So a completely separate artifact that is currently right now housed in a cathedral in Spain in the town of Evita. We just found it very much fascinating about this particular artifact. A lot of people don't know about it. The other thing that we found really interesting is it's only brought out three times a year, on Good Friday and at the start of what's called the Feast of the Cross, which, and Vicki, keep me right, I believe it starts on September 7th and then concludes on September 14th.
Correct.
So we're in it right now.
We're right in the wheelhouse. So that was one of the reasons that we chose the release date of last Tuesday, September 4th. We kind of thought it would be a nice tie-in to the date that this this ceremony is currently going on, and it's when the sidarium is pulled out. And we just kind of thought it fascinating. It's only pulled out three times a year, so we thought, you know, someone could steal that, and it might not even be known for a while. So that was kind of the basis of the entire story we started with. And then we took a lot of time developing a character, a CIA agent, Dr. Samuel Tolan, who we had introduced in a short story about 6 weeks ago. And we wanted to get kind of deeper into a character. Our other two novels, while, you know, had some pretty good characters we developed, we wanted something a little deeper, and we're also looking to take Tolan into a series. So if he survives this ordeal, John, we look forward to carrying him into some other adventures.
And the feedback so far has been absolutely fantastic. That our readers tend to really like Samuel Tolan and identify with him, even despite the fact that he's a government agent. So it's going over very well so far.
We also took the tact.
Go right ahead.
I'm sorry, John. We also took the tact that we wanted to integrate some other people from other countries. So we have a British archaeologist that's also involved on this adventure, and then a Spanish inspector. So we had a nice kind of a grouping of nationalities and different, you know, types of characters that we meshed as they go on this journey, which is really a deadly journey. They're being pursued. While they're pursuing, they're also being pursued by others who are trying to kill them. So.
And when you're talking about an artifact like the Sidarium of Evita, and I guess that it was my mistake when you hear the word cloth, consider with Jesus Christ, people immediately think it's the shroud. And so that was my apologies in thinking now. But so when you're dealing with an artifact that is a lot lesser known, how much difficult is it when you're doing research to kind of find out about exactly, you know, what kinds of things it holds or mysteries it holds and those types of, basis when you're talking about historical fiction like that?
Well, to be honest, there's not a lot of information about the Sidarium out there, so we took everything we could find and kind of wrote around it. So while it is factually accurate and historically correct, we made up some stuff about it too. So,
yeah, I think what was interesting is, as Vicki said, there's some information out there, but by no, it's like the redheaded stepchild to the shroud. I mean, it really is not as well known. It also like the shroud, though, does apparently contain some blood and some lymph on it, but it had hasn't been tested anywhere as much as The Shroud. So we were kind of, again, this goes back to that little historical nugget that when we like to find something like that, we like to really expose it.
And so that does make it for a little bit more difficult when you're writing something like that. When you don't have a lot of information, you kind of have to go out there and you have to do a lot more digging. And did that take a little bit more time while you were writing it? Did you think that you were going to kind of run into those stumbling blocks while you were going ahead and putting the book together?
Yeah, and Vicki, I don't know if you want, you know, touch this. Go ahead, Vic.
I was just going to say that in some ways it's actually easier to write about a lesser-known artifact or a lesser-known historical event in that you can really write around it. This is fiction. This is historical fiction. So if there's not as much known about it and you know your readers aren't going to know as much about it, then we can make up things. But you're right. There's not a lot out there, so the initial research is harder to uncover.
Yeah, I think John.
And again, I just want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with the author team of Gary Williams and Vicki Nerley, and their website is williamsnerley.com, K-N-E-R-L-Y. Sorry, Gary, go ahead.
No, and I'm sorry, I apologize. What I was going to say is, believe it or not, we probably spent just as much time learning the layout of the cathedral and the antechamber where the sedarium is stored and all of the components in the. Right, because we have several scenes that occur in that cathedral. And unfortunately, we weren't able to visit it in Spain, so we had to actually get schematics and do a considerable amount of research just to be able to write some of those scenes. So it's a labor of love, but it definitely was some labor involved in getting some of that research.
Now, the other thing that you kind of threw in, because you always have to have, you know, the good guys chasing the good guys chasing the truth, but then, of course, there's always bad guys chasing the truth. And what you did is you kind of created this rogue group that was called the True Sons of Light. Now, were they kind of based off of any type of real group out there, or was that totally a fictional part made up too?
Well, it's a yes-no answer, John, and I'll explain. There was a group called the True Sons of Light around the time of Jesus Christ. They were also known as the Essenes that lived along the Black Sea and are thought to be responsible for penning the Dead Sea Scrolls. But the True Sons of Light were really from our imagination. We just took a name of a group and just modified it to get us a little conspiracy going.
And if you want to tell, you know, like the readers, and you know they're curious to kind of know more about the characters that were in there, like you said, you know, you mentioned you got the CIA operative in Samuel Tolley, you got the Spanish inspector here in Pascal Diaz, along with the British archaeologist in Dr. Jade Mueller. Which one of the three kind of surprised you while you were writing the book that either had, you know, a bigger part or something that kind of surprised you about the three that was actually pleasantly surprising while you were writing Indisputable Proof?
Dick, do you want to take that? Or?
For me personally, it was the development of Jade, the character of Jade. She actually, this was a rewrite. Originally, it was a completely different story, and Jade had a completely different part. And as we rewrote this several times, Jade actually took on a much bigger character, and we refined her a lot. So I like her. I think she's going to be great when we do the movie of this.
We hope, John. Yeah. And I'll expand on what Vicki said as well. I would think Dr. Jade Mueller as well. One of the things that we wanted to make her have some flaws that really aren't even exposed until kind of later in the story, but we wanted her to seem really human, have some regrets, have some flaws, but yet to have learned from them and to move on. Now, one of the things that occurs in this book is there's some people that appear guilty at certain points along the way who you're really never sure who is guilty. So you don't know who the bad guys are. And we really have a lot of fun doing that. It's always fun to kind of trick your audience along the way as you go.
And we have found from our readers' feedback so far that they really are kept guessing till the end. They suspect the people that we want them to suspect and not the real person until very late in the story.
Now, a lot of writers, of course, you know, there's not a lot of writing teams that are out there. and the dynamic of it can be a little bit difficult, you know, when you have two sides trying to get together, and anytime you kind of have two people, it's always difficult to agree how we can't even agree on our president. So how does the dynamic between the two of you work, and how did it start to where you guys decided, hey, you know what, let's start writing together, and now, like you said, you know, this is your third book that you guys have done.
It's interesting, John. Without giving too much detail, Vicki and I actually met back in late 2007, just online. I had self-published a few books, which shall remain nameless because I really don't want anybody buying them. But Vicki had read through it, liked the story, but I'll be honest, my technical writing skill wasn't up to par, and she kind of told me some of those things, and I decided, you know what the heck, let's form a team, and I offered her, and we got together. We took one of my manuscripts, we reworked it, and within about 4 months, we actually had a literary agent who asked for the whole manuscript, which was a thrill to us, because if any writer has ever tried to get a literary agent's attention, it's next to impossible. So long story short, we were signed to a literary agent. We worked with an agent for about 2.5 years. Unfortunately, it just nothing much came out of it, and we segmented ways a while back. But as far as how Vicki and I work together, we basically, and Vicki makes a joke about this, we sit down and we work on a draft outline. And I usually first come up with some kind of a story, and then we sit down and we go through it. And Vicki keeps me very honest about, you know, this will work, this won't work. And then we collaborate, and then we write it. And the writing is kind of a layered effect. Sometimes I'll write the first draft, and she'll come back and write over it. And what Vicki makes light of is a lot of times we'll argue more about the title than we will about writing the manuscript itself.
It's true. We can write an entire manuscript and get along just fine, and we, you know, debate points and plot lines, and then we get to the title, and you know, it's like we're a married couple fighting.
But,
yeah,
you know, it is kind of a...
That's kind of where the real fun begins, just sitting there worrying more about the title than everything else.
Yeah, and it is kind of a unique relationship because Vicki and I have, because she made a reference to marriage. I mean, most writing couples that are male female are married
to each other.
You know, to each other, and you know, we or you have someone like a Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child who are, you know, same sex writing couples. So we kind of are an anomaly in that regard. And I think Vicki, I was thinking about the other day, we've only met in person probably about 6 times, John.
Yeah, not a lot, but
in the years we've been working together, we do everything online on the phone.
Wow. See, and I guess, you know, the internet can be bad for a lot of bad things, but this is one of those times when the internet could be a very good thing, because probably if it wasn't for the social networking aspect of everything that's going on, the two of you probably would never be getting together, and these books would never be coming to light.
That's very true.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we, like I said, we met online and we continued it from there. And you're absolutely right. Again, I go back to Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. I know those guys at one point, one lived in the Northeast and the other lived in the Midwest. And, you know, it helped them facilitate that same type of arrangement. But it is interesting. And we're very dynamic in that I'm from the Deep South. I was born and raised in Florida. Vicki's from upstate New York, even though she lives in Georgia now. So we've got some really contrasting views and points, but I think it helps when we meld together and come up with these stories.
Now, again, we're speaking with the writing team of Gary Williams and Vicki Nerley about their latest book, Indisputable Proof, which is available right now in ebook form to find wherever you find ebooks, you'll find it. And their website is williamsnerley.com, K-N-E-R-L-Y. .com. So when you kind of look back, and then now, you know, and you're on your website, and you see, like, the four books, when you got Death in the Beginning, Three Keys to Murder, now then you have Before the Proof and Indisputable Proof. When you're kind of looking forward now, and you kind of look, when you look back and then you look forward, how have you been able to evolve more as a team from your first book into your book now, Indisputable Proof? What will the fans notice, I guess, the most about maybe your writing style or kind of how the plots are and how the characters progress and those types of things?
Well, I think, as I kind of touched on before, I think with this last book, you see a little bit more character development. We've developed characters in other novels because you have to. I mean, that's part of the novel, but I think with Samuel Tolan, you see more of a relatable character and some of the angst that he's going through. It's interesting, John, though, you pointed out three books and a short story, and we put out all of those since last November. So we've done this within 9 months. But the reason we were able to do that is because at the time we had worked with a literary agent and we had developed some manuscripts. So it's been kind of a whirlwind 9 months for us because we worked back through every single manuscript and in some cases making dramatic changes. But I do think with its latest book, you see just a little bit more character development, a little bit more flaws in some of the characters. And you know, it seemed to make for a nice story doing that.
And I also think our writing has become a lot tighter. Our plot lines they flow better. And a lot of that is just the development of us as a writing team and getting feedback from other people and other authors as well.
And when you're looking, you know, what's like the first thing that your fans are, you know, the kind of emails that you receive from the fans and the feedback that you get, when, you know, for the ones that followed you from Death in the Beginning now to Indisputable Proof, you know, what are they kind of saying?
Well, I think the ones that have started with us in book one, they're us. They like the historical mysteries. They like ties into things that are historically accurate. And, I mean, that's the type of feedback we get. And we, John, make a point in our books to at the end also review what is historically accurate. Excuse me, I've got a dog barking.
Gotta love dogs. Yeah.
we make a point of going through those things that are historically accurate and melding them in, and that seems to be what captivates people. They really like learning from a novel. You know, like Vicki said, obviously these are novels, but the fact is people do like learning from them.
And so that's kind of one of the big things that you try to do is you're not only telling the story, but you're also, you know, educating in the way of the historical part of, you know, the underlying historical part of the book.
And the feedback has been very positive from people who know any of the history behind what we're writing about, not just in this one, but in the previous novels as well. And they can tell that there's a lot of research that goes into it, and they have said that they learn from our stories as well as enjoying them.
So now moving forward, when you kind of look forward what your guys' career is going to be, of course you're going to probably stay in the historical fiction category. I'm sure you probably already have, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 different events that you want to conquer. Do you know what your next book is going to be? Is it going to be Samuel Poland? Is it going to be Evolved? Is it going to be a series involved with that character? Or are you going to do, are you going to bring somebody else in?
No, I think as authors, John, and probably anybody will tell you this, you have to be working in your mind at least on the next book as you're finishing, you know, a book. So we've, and just to caveat, when you say historical fiction, I just want to make people understand we're not writing fiction that takes place in the past. It's just fiction linked to the past. So,
right.
But we do have some other stories that are definitely we've got the idea for a novella that we're developing, and the other novel that we're working on is actually going to be a sequel to our first novel, Death in the Beginning. We're going to bring back the characters that, again, survived that ordeal and put out a novel next year called Evil in the Beginning. And we're leaning towards actually bringing Samuel Toland into that novel. So what we're going to have is some universes cross. We did that with our second novel. We brought a character back from the first one who had kind of a cameo. But this will be a clearly crossing of the universes with this next novel that comes out next year.
And is that one of the difficult things that you're seeing, is that now when you're going to do kind of the crossover, is the dynamic between those older characters and now your newer characters?
I think our biggest problem is trying not to kill them off so that we can bring them back.
Yeah, that's always true.
Yeah, Vicki's got a point there. But I think, John, we enjoy it. I mean, we have fun. You know, as a writer, you kind of relate to your characters at some point, and we like taking a character like Kurt Lohan, he's an archaeologist, but he's kind of a humorous guy in some ways, and then pitting him, maybe not pitting him against, but matching him up in a book with a Samuel Toland who's a little bit more straight-laced. So it adds for a lot of opportunities for some interesting storyline.
Well, guys, I'll tell you what, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It is always great to see, you know, the type of dedication and the type of detail in writing, especially, like you said, you know, kind of an historical artifact that is probably more forgotten than more well-known. In your book here, Indisputable Proof, Gary Williams, Vicki Nerley, we want to thank you so much for coming on. So you guys have a wonderful day, and we look forward to seeing what's coming on in the future.
Thanks, John.
We appreciate it.
All right. You guys have a good one. We will talk with you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that was Gary Williams and Vicki Nerley, the writing team and author of the book Indisputable Proof, williamnerley.com, K-N-E-R-L-Y. You can get the book wherever books, ebooks are sold. Pick it up right now. It's $2.99. So you're able to get a fascinating read, very good price, $2.99. Go out, pick it up. Then you can go back and get Death in the Beginning, and then you'll be able to see, like they said in 2013, they're going to have the sequel to Death in the Beginning. So a lot of great things coming out, and these are the types of authors that we get very excited upon, because the hardworking ones, the ones out there hitting the nose to the grind and just doing everything they can to find and entertain fans like yourself. Right now we are going to play a new audio clip that we received. It's by an author called Anthony Howard. The book is called Invisible Enemy. And then after that clip, we will be back on with our next guest, R. Barry Flowers. So in the meantime, enjoy this clip.
Cold War era, the KGB, the former Soviet Union's equivalent of the CIA, ruled using cutthroat rings of highly trained intelligence operatives. During this period, the Soviet arms count was estimated at over 40,000 nuclear weapons. Because of the breakdown of the Soviet Union and its KGB, over 250,000 skilled Soviet spies, strategically planted around the world, suddenly found themselves out of work. However, for many of the displaced agents, it was still business as usual, as many of those unclaimed 250,000 spies were children, an enemy invisible to nearly any defense mechanism.
Get in and get out. What do you think this is, some kind of game? Devin snarled. I just thought I do the thinking. All you do is what I say, Devin coldly replied. Garrett was silent. He looked into the boss's cold eyes and saw no understanding, no mercy, and no patience. There was no compassion between the two men. In and out, sir, was Garrett's meek reply. But it was just an act. There was no fear in Garrett's heart. Take teams A and F and complete the operation, Devin said. You will signal Man 3 at 9:15 a.m. Enter the facility at 9:18. Expedite the operation exactly as planned and exit at 9:21. Are there any questions, Mr. Garrett? The boss's tone told him there had better not be. No, sir. Good. Team A will be waiting for you at the designated rendezvous point. The truck will be with them. Nightshade leads Team F at your signal. She already has the keys in her possession. Dismissed. Yes, sir. Garrett turned to leave. Garrett. Yes? One more thing. Teams A and F are to be totally oblivious to each other. Is that understood? Of course, sir.
Sorry, everyone. That Pulitzer competition belongs to me.
Dorian Valentine exclaimed on her way to work. As she walked past the doors of the elevator, she received a standing ovation, and she welcomed it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dorian, some people are here to see you in the boss's office, said Frederick Carson, one of her co-workers.
What? The Pulitzer is here already.
Good morning, Miss Valentine, a stranger in a gray suit said. He stepped in close and locked his arm in hers. He then started to walk quickly, leading her to the editor-in-chief's office. In a separate, windowless van parked on a Washington side street, Kalisa Leonilla, known to her team as Nightshade, rebriefed Team F on the operation at hand.
All right, take a good look at this picture,
Nightshade instructed.
Everyone and everything else is expendable.
Get your hands off of me. What is going on? And who the hell do you think you are putting your hands on me? I ought to pick up the phone right now and call my attorney. You better start explaining yourself right now.
Sit down, Dorian, one of the men said.
I'm fine. Standing.
Miss Valentine, we're from the CIA, he continued. This is about the article you wrote that is printed in this morning's paper. I'm sure you know you've created absolute congressional pandemonium.
Just doing my job. And what's your name?
Valentine was cut off by the sounds of terrified screams coming from outside. Get down, Turner yelled to Valentine. Clack drew his piece. Automatic gunfire was heard over the screams, followed by shattered glass and chaos.
Dorian Valentine!
So again, everybody, we would like to thank you for joining us here on our second segment, and that was, again, author Anthony Howard's clip called The Invisible Enemy. You can Google that and search and find out more about Anthony as you want. So now, right now, we want to welcome our next guest. Barry Flowers is on the show. So, Barry, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, John. Thanks for having me.
Now, your website is rbarryflowers.com, but that's B-A-R-R-I, flowers.com, to let people kind of know where they can go and find out all your work, because you've written a lot of stuff. But your latest book here is a true crime called Masters of the True Crime. So can you kind of tell everybody a little bit about the book and, you know, what people can expect when they pick it up?
Absolutely, yes. Masters of True Crime, Chilling Stories of Murder in the Macabre, is a true crime anthology, and it features 17 gripping tales by some of the best true crime writers in the business today, such as Harold Schechter, Dr. Catherine Ramsland, Burl Bearer, Carol Ann Davis, Kathy Scott, and Robert J. Watkins, among others. And this anthology is really something that true crime writers and readers, and thriller readers will want to get their hands on. It has some very good tales that will show why the truth is stranger than fiction when it comes to gripping mystery tales that has a satisfying resolution.
Now, the stories that are in the book here, are all of them set in the United States, or are they kind of set worldwide?
The majority of them are set in the United States, but there are a few abroad, such as one written by Carol Ann Davis, who's a Scottish true crime writer, and she writes a very chilling story about a British arsonist and serial killer named Peter Dinsdale, who was only 12 years old when he claimed his first victim in the early 1970s. Dinsdale went on to murder at least 15 people as a result of arson. So that's one illustration of a crime that happened, takes place in another country that is very well told. And the crime took place at the same time that a guy named Peter Sutcliffe, who was known as Yorkshire Ripper, was doing his thing in the 70s. And yet this killer that Carol Ann Davis talks about, Peter Dinsdale, actually killed more people than the Yorkshire Ripper. So
wow.
Definitely one that readers will enjoy reading, finding fascinating.
See, the one thing, and the one thing about true crime that I guess a lot of people, you know, you don't really hear a lot about it, because if the killer, I guess, is not considered what they say the Hollywood-style murders, they really don't get a lot of media and press. So a lot of people don't know about these types of people, because when you mention some of the names, people are like, who are these people? And, you know, what's going on? And I guess that, you know, you bringing them more to light is, you know, being able to let people realize that all these things go on, you just might not know about it.
Absolutely. Yes. A perfect example, in fact, is a story that I've written for the anthology about a serial killer named Donald Miller, who graduated from Michigan State University, which happens to be my alma mater, and he went on to become a serial killer, murdering four women, sexually assaulting them as well, including his ex-fiancée. So he was murdering these women in and around Michigan State University in the mid-1970s before being finally brought to justice. So few people have heard of Donald Miller, but once they read this, they'll certainly come to know of him, and also maybe feel a little less secure in the campus environment that's generally portrayed as a nice educational setting that's safe for students. But you can always come up with some person like Miller who may be lurking in the shadows to be, you know, as dangerous as a Ted Bundy or one of the other killers out there, or the Green River Killer, many of the other killers that are more well-known, but some other killers that aren't as well-known are equally lethal. You can never
be careful. And during that time in the 70s, I mean, of course, you had the Son of Sam, and then you had the Ted Bundy stuff that was going on, and sometimes, you know, those things kind of get lost in the shuffle, like, you know, a character like Donald Miller. But what was kind of your intention? Because, you know, you've written so many books, you know, on your own. What was kind of the intention to be able to kind of do this anthology now, you know, Masters of True Crime?
Well, I wanted to gather some of the finest true crime writers on the scene today to sort of get the different styles that these talented authors have and their take on different cases that they found fascinating that they felt readers would find equally fascinating. So I just went about contacting some of these writers, many, you know, whom I've admired over the years, and it worked out well. They were, you know, enthusiastic in their participation and came up with some really delightful and scary tales that, you know, gives indication of just, you know, how much talent they have and how, and a reflection of their other writings that they have out there.
Yeah, and one of the books that I find interesting that you write, and again, we're speaking here with author R. Barry Flowers, and it's rbarryflowers.com, B-A-R-R-I, flowers.com. One of the true crime books that you wrote here, which was a tale about America's first husband and wife serial killer team set in 1977 to 1980, was called The Sex Slave Murders. Now, I got to be honest, is that, you know, I grew up in 1970, and that was when I was born, and so I was kind of very young at that time. But even, you know, looking past, you know, looking back and now looking forward, I had never even known of the two people here, Gerald and, you know, Charlene Gallego. How did kind of they kind of run under the radar, and how were you able to kind of find out, you know, their three-year spree that they had going on and to write about the book, The Sex Slave Murders?
Well, first of all, John, I'd like to say I'm very happy to see that The Sex Slave Murders was one of your magazine's best books last year, I believe.
Yes, it was, for true crime.
Yes, so that was great, and well, the Sex Slave Murders, I came about, my interest in this project came from my living in the Sacramento area at the time that these two murderers, the husband and wife, Gerald and Charlene Gallego, as they were perpetrating these crimes in Sacramento, California, to start their crime spree. I had just moved there with my wife, just newly wed, just out of college, and so the last two people the Gallegos murdered were college sweethearts, and so that had an effect on me, realizing that I was, you know, just young, or could have very well been just gotten out of college, could have been me and my wife, so that inspired me to look further into this case, and then these two individuals and the fascinating story of their lives, of how they came from two separate backgrounds. Gerald Gallego's father was a double murderer who had been executed himself, sort of the bad seed, if you will. Gerald Gallego, following his father's footsteps as a murderer. And then you had Charlene, who came from a well-to-do family and seemed like she had everything going for her, but she still had this desire to break away from suburbia and found herself attracted to the bad boy in Gerald Gallego, and the two of them together made a lethal combination as they went on to murder 10 people, including 9 women, one of them 4 months pregnant. And
wow.
Yes, they became the first husband and wife serial killer team in this country, and their crime spree was motivated by sex slave fantasies, in which Gerald harbored these dark thoughts of abducting young women and having them as his sex slaves. And so this moved up, went from fantasy to reality, and they began abducting young women and doing this and having them as his sex slaves before he and Charlene murdered them, and often dumping in the desert or the woods. And only by good fortune were they ever apprehended, because they were perpetrating their crimes in 3 different states, Oregon, Nevada, and California, and they were moving back and forth, so the authorities were never able to really connect the dots until they already killed 10 people.
You know, the thing that fascinates me sometimes about, like, these serial killers is, like, the fact, you know, they're going between 3 states and they're doing all of these kinds of things. It's like, how are they funding themselves? You know, I mean, because that takes, you know, a little bit amount of money to be able to kind of jump back and forth and do these things. And it's kind of like, you know, how do they get their funding to be able to do these things? I mean, I work, you know, 9 to 5. I don't have time to take a freaking vacation. I more or less jump around 3 states.
Well, in the case of the Gallegos, Charlene often tapped into her parents' funds. They were only too happy to support their only child, rich, spoiled daughter, who took advantage of her parents in that respect. They were unbeknownst to them that she was supporting a murderer, her and Gerald, and so that's one way they got money. They also worked odd jobs to help keep them afloat. But that's a very good point you make. It does seem like when you've got these killers out doing their thing, it makes you wonder, how are they supporting themselves and doing the regular things in life to keep going? But I think that's one of the most interesting things about killers, is that they do have normal lives in spite of their dark side. They are able to function, you know, normally among society, work, play, friends, family, even church. But behind the scenes, they're able to perpetrate these deadly crimes, and in many instances are able to get away with it for a while before they're finally apprehended.
Now, again, we're speaking here with author Arbery Flowers. That's arberryflowers.com, B-A-R-R-I. And when people go on, they're going to see that, you know, you have written, you know, many different style of books, you know, from legal thrillers to mystery to young adult and to true crime. Do you have one specific genre that, you know, really kind of captivates you into to say, you know, this is really the one that I you know, that I love to write the most of, is this type of genre, when you look back at all the kind of genres that you do get into?
Absolutely, yes. I love writing thriller fiction. I consider that my forte as a writer. I've written some great ones. I've gotten some great reviews, such as Murder in Maui, Lila Kahana Mystery, and Murder in Honolulu, a Sky Delaney mystery. I spent a lot of time in Hawaii.
Yeah, poor Hawaii. You're killing them off.
Yes. I found that beautiful environment to be the perfect setting, really, for murder, because by appearance, it, you know, gives you the impression that it's just a tranquil, safe, beautiful environment, everything perfect. But beyond the facade, killers can lurk in Hawaii as well as any other state, and so that was really what I wanted to show, to use that environment, atmosphere, to show that danger can lurk anywhere, and it can be particularly engaging for a reader, especially one who has gone to Hawaii, to then imagine Hawaii in that type of situation, where beyond the beaches and the palm trees and mountains and ocean, killers can still be at work, making things just a little creepier than at a first glance.
And, you know, and when you're, because true crime is one of those genres that is very much like a cult following. You don't have a lot of people that, you know, that read mystery and thriller and suspense, and then they kind of go over and they kind of read true crime. True crime writers are like science fiction, readers. True crime readers are kind of the same thing. They're very loyal to their authors and very loyal to their genre. How are you kind of able to bridge your fans from, you know, your mysteries and your thrillers and then into your true crime? Are you kind of leaving the same writing style the same, so they still get that same familiarity with you as an author?
That's a great question, John. I think that I'm able to bridge the gap between the genres for fans of mine, in that because I'm a criminologist by background and I've written numerous criminology books in true crime, that I'm able to bring the type of credibility to my thrillers and mystery novels that almost reads like true crime, and yet it's really fiction. And so I think that I'm able to appeal to true crime fans and thriller fans, and that for both, it has a sense of realism that many authors may not have in their writings, especially mystery writers who may not, you know, have a full grasp of the psychology of criminals and their psyche and the processes that causes real criminals to commit these crimes that you read about in fiction, that are, in many instances, the writers may talk about things more mechanically without, you know, having the insight that a criminologist would have as to what really makes a criminal tick, a person being willing to cross the line and murder someone else and then keep on going about his or her normal business as though, you know, it were just an everyday thing.
So when you're writing true crime and then you're going into your fiction, does it make it easier for you to go ahead and write fiction, since with writing true crime? And so what I'm trying to say is that, you know, you see what the truth is, and then you're able to spin it into a different kind of way, you know, when you're doing your thriller fiction.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, it does make it easier to write the fiction because I'm equipped with the knowledge of true crimes and the various things involved with the crime scene and police investigations and the lawyers on both sides and, you know, what they're thinking, how they're going about dealing with the case when it goes to trial, and the dark processes in the minds of criminals themselves that drive them to committing these crimes. And so when I'm doing fiction, I have the knowledge of what happens with real criminals, real murderers, and rapists and other violent criminals, to put it together in a way that does not require of the same type story as a true crime story, in that it doesn't have to have all the facts lined up properly because it is a true crime, so you can stretch the truth and, you know, use your creative juices, if you will, to tell a tale that in which you incorporate all the best parts of a true crime book while telling a fictional story. So I really love writing thrillers for that reason, including, as you noted, earlier legal thrillers. Some of my best books, State's Evidence, Persuasive Evidence, and Justice Served, have been best-selling legal thrillers that have allowed me to really take modern contemporary tales and turn them into legal thrillers, great courtroom drama that my fans have, you know, applauded me for. And it's been really great for me to be able to lend my voice to the fiction community as well as true crime. And in some instances, I've been able to bridge the true crime and fictional thrillers even more, such as a historical thriller I've written called Dark Streets of Whitechapel, which is a Jack the Ripper mystery. And so I use Jack the Ripper, the real killer, put up my own twist on this killer, have him being an American killer, which is historically has been listed by, amongst other criminologists, as plausible, since with Jack the Ripper, no one knows for sure who Jack the Ripper was, even if Jack the Ripper was a male. Some people feel that Jack the Ripper was a female who may have been able to lurk behind the shadows, such as a midwife killing these prostitutes and then being able to escape more easily, being a female that, you know, the police may not have noticed as much as they would have a male killer. But in any event, in my book, I have a killer escaped from New York City who was killing prostitutes in New York City in 1888 and then take a ship to London and then continue his killing ways of prostitutes in the Whitechapel section of London. And then I have a American detective come over to England to try and capture Jack the Ripper, stopping him from his pursuit of prostitutes. But because I'm familiar with the Jack the Ripper killings, the real killings, I was able to incorporate that into my story so that you get a very sense of realism when you read Dark Streets of Whitechapel, and that you're getting both the true crimes that were committed by this serial killer, Victorian era, and you're getting the fictional aspect that, you know, takes into account the times, you know, the different things that were going on in the late 1800s, and you end up with a very absorbing tale that I'm sure that readers of my fans have already embraced this story, but I'm sure new readers will also find this a riveting tale of fiction that is also bordered in true crime.
You know, and it's interesting that you brought that up, because that was going to be my next question, because I'm a huge, I mean, I don't know if it's right to say a huge Jack the Ripper fan, but I do find that that's one of my most intriguing mysteries is Jack the Ripper, and I love the spin that you were able to do to kind of create your killer kind of around, so you're almost bringing a real-life person into a fictional story to kind of have, you know, your character kind of chase him down, and
right.
You know, and then that's kind of what it is. But and I just find that's absolutely fascinating. But yeah, I mean, and that's the one thing that I want to let a lot of people know is, because we're out of time, is that, you know, your library is very extensive and very diverse in your writing. So you're going to kind of find a little bit of everything when they decide to pick up one of your books, because, you know, you kind of run the gamut on a lot of different genres, which is not a very easy thing to do, and it's great to see someone like yourself, you know, do it so successfully. And, you know, we just want to thank you so much for coming on today and sharing just a little bit about, you know, the stuff that you've done and the stuff that you're continuing to do.
Well, it's my pleasure to be on the show, John, and I'm glad to be able to introduce myself to readers who may not have heard of me or be familiar with my works. And yes, I do have some great stories out there in true crime and thrillers and mysteries and young adult mysteries. One of my young adult mysteries, Ghost Girl in Shadow Bay, is a haunted
yep.
house mystery that I believe young adults and adults alike would find gripping. That's a story trying to solve a 50-year-old murder mystery that borders into the paranormal, but it's also a very contemporary mystery suspense novel. So I'm glad that I had this opportunity to come on your show, and I hope that readers not only read my books, look me up on Google or Yahoo or in Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes. You'll find me there. You can also follow me on Twitter, befriend me or contact me on Facebook, YouTube, Goodreads, Library Thing, and www.rberrywithanflowers.com.
And so there you have it. Thank you so much, Barry, for coming on, and we look forward to seeing what's coming up next for you, and we will speak with you later.
Sounds good, John. I look forward to talking with you again.
All right. Thank you. So, again, everybody, that was R.B. Flowers and the extensive amount of library that he is able to write and continues to write. It's rberryflowers.com. That's Barry with an I. To check out a lot of the stuff and everything that he has written. And like he said, follow him on, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and be able to stay up in contact with everything that he's doing. We are going to now take another quick break, and we are going to be back with our last guest, Sylvia Grenatier from France, whose book, The Paris Lawyer, is now being translated into English for the first time. So it should be interesting to hear everything that she's done, as she's an author, screenwriter, and an actress. And it's going to be fascinating to talk with her. So we will see you here shortly when she comes back. Until then, all in notes. I want to welcome everybody back here to our last segment. What I'm going to say here is that Sylvia is not on the line yet, and I'm not sure exactly what happened or what is going on. We're going to try to see if we can find that out. But in the matter of time, we are probably going to go and end the show here now, an hour in, and hopefully we will get Sylvia back on the air to talk about her book. We will be on next weekend also, and we have a lot of exciting guests that are going to be on next weekend's show, which starts at 10 a.m., author Kathy Reichs. You know her from the Bone series. Of course, you know, it's her books that made the show popular on the Fox station. So she's going to be on along with John Trudell and Ralph Pizzolo. And that show, again, like I said, will start at 10 a.m. next Saturday. So in the meantime, everybody, we want to thank you all. We want to thank our three guests, actually, the writing team of Gary Williams and Vicki Nerley that came on early. And that is williamsnerley.com. And then we also want to thank that we just had R. Barry Flowers, and that's R. Barry Flowers, Barry with an I, .com, to go and check out his information. Gary Williams and Vicki Nerley, their book is called Indisputable Proof. Go check that out wherever books are sold. R. Barry Flowers, the Masters of True Crime, along with his whole extensive library. Go check out R. Barry Flowers. Until next time, everybody, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Hopefully my SodaStream worked later in the show and I was able to be a little bit more enthusiastic. And we'll just have to let that roll through my bloodstream as the week goes on. So until next Saturday, thank you so much for joining us. SuspenseMagazine.com is the website. Check us all out. See ya.